Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, journalist and historian Tim Spofford discusses his book, What the Children Told Us, the untold story of the famous doll test and the black psychologists who changed the world. The following conversation originally took place February 6th, 2024, and was recorded live at the American Writers Museum.
Hi, folks. Great to see all of you here tonight. My name's Allison Sansoni. I'm the program director here at the American Writers Museum. This program is offered in conjunction with our exhibit, Dark Testament, A Century of Black Writers on Justice. I want to thank you all for being here and for supporting the past, present, and future of American writing. In 1940, two psychologists asked black children to choose between two dolls, one white and one black. Their answers would form the basis for studying the effects of and eventually attempting to dismantle legal segregation in American society. Tim Spofford tells the story of the psychologists who pioneered the study in What the Children Told Us. He has a doctorate in English and has worked for years in classrooms and newsrooms, written for the New York Times, Newsday, Mother Jones Magazine, and many other publications. He's also the author of Lynch Street, a documentary account of the Jackson State killings in Mississippi in May of 1970. Please join me in welcoming him.
Thank you, Allison, for that introduction.
Well, thank you for being here and discussing this with us. Tell us a little bit about what the doll test was and why it was so important.
Well, the doll test was a test of, I guess you could say, racial identity for children from the ages of about 2 to 8. Most of the children were well above 2, but there were a few that were 2 and 3 toddlers. The Clarks would, Kenneth was the one who was administering it. Mamie was very busy giving birth and raising 2 children. So he was the one who went out into the field. And he would show a child 4 dolls, and they'd be in a staggered, integrated lineup. So no 2 white dolls together, 2 black dolls together. It was black, brown, white, brown, white. And then he would say, the first question would always be, which is the doll that you would like to play with? Which is the doll that you like best? And then another question would be, which is the nice doll? The next question would be, which is the bad doll? And always the last question was, which is the doll that looks like you? And now the children that they tested were only black children, that's all. At the time, they did the testing both in the South and in the North. And in the South, a black professor like Kenneth Clark could not even get inside a white school, much less question a white child or touch a white child. I mean, that was verboten. That was absolutely taboo. And so, two-thirds of the children opted for a white doll. They said they preferred a white doll. And some of the children had made pejorative remarks about the doll that closest really resembled them or represented them. And some of the children, definitely a tiny minority, a fraction, but some of the children denied they were even black. And some of the children cried and ran out of the testing room. So Kenneth felt pretty guilty about that. And but the doll test was more than just the doll test. We always focus on that, but the test was actually quite a bit more complicated. It had an IQ test that was part of it. There was a coloring test that Mamie developed. And so there was, the children were asked to take crayons of various colors and color the picture of, really a line drawing of a boy, the color that you think boys should be and the color that you think girls should be, that kind of thing. and they would contrast these with the DAL test scores and look for some sort of consistency or lack thereof. There was also a sketch test where the children were asked to indicate whether they identified with picture of a black boy or a black girl or white boy or a white girl. And there was a certain kind of internal consistency. If you look at all the children, it was more than 253 that they tested in 1940 and 1941. But two-thirds of the children opted for the white doll as their favorite, the one they wanted to play with, the one they'd like to have.
Tell us a little bit about the clerks and how they came to be studying this.
Well, a lot of what I am saying about the activity behind the doll test revolves around Kenneth, because he's the one who actually did the testing. But Mamie was actually really, really central, totally central. And if it weren't for Mamie, we wouldn't be sitting here right now listening to this conversation. Mamie did a master's degree at Howard. That's where she and Kenneth met, Howard University in Washington. And her project for her master's thesis was to try to study the age at which children begin to demonstrate a consciousness of self as distinct human beings. Now, that actually had nothing to do with race, really. But she heard about this prior test by Ruth Horowitz, Dr. Ruth Horowitz in New York City, psychologist. And Dr. Ruth, she did this test using drawings of only black boys and white boys, but also, oddly, animals like a rooster, a dog, a lion. There might have been one or two other animals, and to try to test the see with only nursery school children to see whether they had a sense of themselves as human beings yet. And some of the kids actually were so young and undeveloped that they actually opted for some of the animals. And so this is how first Dr. Horowitz and then Mamie began to make decisions about, or guesses, good guesses based on information, data, when children really begin to sense that they are human beings. But in that first test for her master's, there was a strange thing that some of the black children were opting for, they identified with the picture of the white boy or the white girl. And actually, Ruth didn't use girls. She only used boys. That was another problem with that test. And so what Mamie's thesis was doing is really testing Ruth's test to see if it was valid, to see if it was any good. Because Dr. Horowitz theorized that these black children that answered the way they did by opting for the pictures of a white boy really wished they were white. And Mamie didn't agree with that. She didn't think that was accurate. That was Mamie's hypothesis. And in doing her own test, she wanted to see whether Ruth's really held up to scrutiny. It was a very ambitious master's thesis. She tested more than 200 children, and she tested children in New York and in Washington, D.C. Again, only black children. Again, because of segregation in Washington, D.C., which was a totally, strictly segregated city, our nation's capital, she would not be allowed inside the doors of a white school. So, okay, after that came out, she and Kenneth became fascinated. Kenneth was a doctoral student at the time at Columbia, while Mamie was finishing her master's, and he became more interested in that than his own dissertation. And so he wasn't finished with this, and she wasn't finished with it either. What about this theory of wishful thinking that they were white? So they decided to design a more sensitive test with dolls. And I think they probably did kind of hit the jackpot. But unfortunately, maybe a little too sensitive, because Kenneth came to the decision that really he kind of harmed some of these children. He made them feel very, very ill at ease, anxious, weeping, and so on. He felt really guilty.
You touched on this a moment ago, but tell us a little bit about the what the environment was that the clerks were doing this work in, the segregation, the separation of Black and white children.
Sure. Well, they did the testing first in Springfield, Massachusetts, which had a long tradition. Massachusetts had a considerably long tradition of integrated schooling. This is 1940, October of 1940. And that's the kind of state Massachusetts was. And I would call that a nominally integrated state. However, Arkansas, where Mamie was from and where Kenneth did the second half of the testing, was a strictly segregated Southern state. So now what were schools and institutions like at that time with regard to segregation? Let's start with schooling, because that's really what this book is about. Chiefly about, it's about segregation throughout American life, but in any case, in schooling, if you were a Southern Black child and you were a teenager and you were living in a rural area, there was a darn good chance you weren't going to get into a high school because there was none in your rural community. And, you know, the school board, the white school board, was happy with that. I mean, no problem. In those rural communities, would you believe Black parents had to very often buy the land? They had to buy the lumber and the roofing materials. They had to actually help construct the school building. They got little or no help from the school board whatsoever. No school buses. The white kids got the buses, but not the Black kids. The schools often seated with money from Julius Rosenwald from Chicago. Julius Rosenwald was connected to the Sears retail industry, and he was a tycoon, had a lot of money, and he provided seed money. He didn't pay the full freight, but he provided the seed money to build schools throughout the South. So a lot of those schools I'm talking about are called Rosenwald schools. And in many cases, because of the very flimsy construction and so on, they had leaking roofs. They all, virtually all in the rural areas, had outhouses. This is into the 1950s, by the way. That's when I was a kid. I mean, a little kid. Into the 1950s, my Black contemporaries at that time were going to schools without water fountains. They had a bucket, perhaps a dipper. And that's how you got your water. Maybe that was put on the front steps of the schoolhouse, which was rickety and flimsy, made of wood. And there were pot-bellied stove. I'm talking chiefly about rural areas. Pot-bellied stove. If the coals went out on the floor, you took a pair of tongs. One kid had to take a pair of tongs and throw the embers back into the fire. Let's see, can you imagine outhouses? Oh, it's just terrible. So that's the way the schools were. As far as other institutions, the Clarks are a pretty good example. The book goes into some detail about that. They both went to Ivy League school, Columbia, to get their doctorates. Both became psychologists, PhDs, and they both had a hell of a time in the 1940s getting their first job. It was very discouraging, and especially for Mamie, who wanted to hire a female scholar, white or Black. But if you were Black, I mean, wow, your chances of getting a job in academia were just about nil. Everything was segregated, and even in New York City, the hospitals that Blacks were expected to attend was Harlem Hospital. Only Black nurses could work there, and the only hospital they could serve in as interns, beginning practicing nurses, was Harlem Hospital. Everything about our society was totally segregated. housing. If you wanted an FHA loan, you weren't going to get it if you were Black. I mean, virtually no one got it. The GI Bill, if you wanted a GI Bill, not many Black soldiers got the GI Bill. That's America, North or South. And I always thought it was kind of interesting that the Clark's Dahl test results were pretty much the same, both for the kids from the integrated schools and the kids from the segregated schools. Because the even if the kids went to an integrated school, the general society was rigidly, rigidly segregated. I grew up in that world in the 1950s. I was a little kid. I didn't grow up in the 50s, but I was around, born in 1950. And that was simply the way it was. I mean, you virtually never saw a Black face on a television set unless it had something to do with the news and crime. In our magazines, the same thing. I mean, it filtered. When people say today racism is systemic, yeah, it is. It is. And I lived through it. I remember it, all aspects of life.
So when they were, when the Clarks began this, they were looking at people's self-image. They were looking at children's, the way they conceived of themselves and what they thought of as good or bad as it related to skin color. What were the effects of this information? What did they do with it?
Oddly, at first, nothing. They had colleagues who wanted them to publish, and they didn't for 7 years, seven long years. And it's kind of amazing. And I think of it this way, that Kenneth felt guilty about doing this test. So that was a part of it. Second of all, they weren't completely certain that they had found what they think they had found. In other words, these were really smart people. These were not people that saw life as pretty simple, cut and dry, black or white. They theorized, their hypothesis was that they had found evidence of an inferiority complex among Black children in 1940 and in 1941. They thought that that's what they found. But when they wrote to the Rosenwald Fund, which had basically paid for their study, they reported that it simply, very cautiously, they said, it raised questions about the education and mental hygiene of Black children. And they're still being very cagey. They thought they'd found it, but they were still uncertain. That's the way they were. But as Kenneth worked with the NAACP, and Mamie did too, they both testified in the federal courts in the litigation that led to Brown versus Board of Education in 1954. As they sat in courtrooms and they listened to all these other social scientists testify, and they read and read and read more social science tests along the lines of what they had conducted. There were other Dahl tests right after them. There was suddenly a lot of interest in Dahl testing, and suddenly white kids started taking Dahl tests too. And so we got their answers, and that was fascinating to read about as well. But then they became, as they were testifying in court and so on, they became pretty certain that, yeah, we found it. What we thought we found, we found.
And so they, the information that they gathered became the basis for challenging segregation because it demonstrated harm.
Yes.
To.
Right.
Yeah.
The last major decision in the Supreme Court on this subject of segregation and human psychology was in 1896, the Plessy versus Ferguson case. And in that case, the Supreme Court ruled that that as long as the facilities in schools, restaurants, hotels, whatever, were equal to white facilities, then separate but equal was fine. And if Blacks didn't like that, then, and that made them feel inferior, then that was pretty much the construction within their own minds. Now, that was the arrogant phrasing, and I'm not giving you an exact quote, but that's very close to it, that the Supreme Court in 1896 rendered. So what Thurgood wanted to do was to basically take a look at that. Well, let's look at what this has done to the minds of these children. What are we saying to these kids when they say, no school bus for you, the white kids can have it. No chem lab for you, the white kids can have it. No auto shop for you, the white kids can have it though. What are we saying to these children about themselves as human beings? What are we conveying? What is the state of Maryland or Virginia or Delaware saying to that black child? And that's what they were doing in these courtrooms. There were 5 court cases, one in Washington that the NAACP did not push. They supported, but they weren't behind it. But there were 4 states and Delaware, Virginia, Kansas, and I'm leaving one out. I always do. Oh, South Carolina. Yeah, South Carolina. Those were the states where this testimony played out in the lower court, federal court, before it got to the Supreme Court, rolled up as one case that we now call Brown.
How did you, as a writer, your background is in journalism and education reporting. How did you first become aware of the Clarks and their story?
That's an interesting story. I was just 17 years old, and I learned probably the way a lot of white college students learned about the Dell test in psychology class. So I was in a big auditorium, about 300, 200 students, darkened auditorium, professors up on the psychology prof is up on the stage, lights are on him, it's 8 o'clock in the morning, it's up near the Canadian border, it's freezing cold. And he talked about Kenneth Clark and the Dell test, and he told that story. And I thought it was a heartbreaking story. I was only 17, but I was capable of feeling pain at a story like that. And I guess I had journalist's genes, didn't know it. I had a pretty good memory for names, and that comes in handy, doesn't it? And I also loved reading the New York Times. And Kenneth Clark was at that time, he was like the Henry Louis Gates Jr. of the 60s and 70s. He was ubiquitous. He was on television all the time. He was in the New York Times all the time. So often it almost seemed like he ran space there. And it was real easy to follow his career just as a newspaper reader. And so from 17 on, that name stuck with me. I said, oh, it's that guy again. It's that guy again. I'm pretty sure it's the same guy. And so, all right, I leave teaching, which I did quite a few years, and went to journalism. And I got to cover the State Board of Regents. It was like statewide school board, except for they controlled both higher education and what we called little education, K through 12, and both private and public sector. So a very, very powerful board. Kenneth Clark was on that board. And I went to cover the first meeting, and he was there. And I was so moved to see this historic figure, this little, round, you know, soft-voiced, round-shouldered 70-year-old man speaking to his colleagues, and they're all hanging on his every word. And all these public servants, civil servants are bowing and scraping, kowtowing to him. He's living history. And there are pictures of these white guys, of former regents on the granite walls of the place. You may have heard of some of them. Alexander Hamilton, maybe you heard of him. He was a regent. John Jay, who signed the Declaration of Independence, another founder. His portrait is there. And then there was this little black man with a soft voice, who was, as I said, living history. Well, I got to interview him that day for about an hour and a half. And his wife had recently died. Mamie had died. And so I expressed my condolences to him. He was very depressed. People had prepared me for this. And he put his hand to his stomach and he said, I feel like I've lost an organ. And when he said that, I said to myself, somebody's got to write this guy's biography. There's a great love story here. And I eventually got to write it.
How did you approach the story when you first started writing it? And did that change during the writing process?
Well, definitely. I don't think anybody writes what they think they're going to at the outset. That's for sure. The first part of your question was what? What was that?
How did you first approach the story, and then how did that change?
Well, if by approach you mean how did I research it, I'd read some books about how to write a biography, which is, I think, a good way a neophyte biographer approaches the task, get a sense of how other people have done it. And I got good advice, and that was, go out and interview all the old people you need to talk to first. Mm-hmm. Okay, as you read this book, there's a lot of quotations from people who knew the Clarks, and they're in here, and they're speaking to you from the grave, because I interviewed them a long time ago. And so that was terrific advice. I have to tell you that Kenneth had, this is part of why it took so long to write this and research it, Kenneth was a pack rat. He kept everything, and his papers were voluminous during the Library of Congress, and there were almost 500 boxes. If you're going to read every word, and I would recommend that anybody who does a biography do that, read every word written by the people you're writing about. That takes some time. So I lived almost a year in Washington over a period of years doing all that. And that was really exciting. And that really got me fired up, particularly their love letters, which they had written every summer. And in the 2 or 3 years they were separated, he was up in New York City at Columbia getting his doctorate, and she's at Howard at the end doing her master's thesis. What a great way to get a good fix on a personality, to take two psychologists no less, who are psychoanalyzing each other. And I mean, I'm just sitting there and I'm reading. I'm saying, hey, man, this is great. You know, they're making it easy for me. So I didn't expect that. I didn't think anybody was going to make it that easy for me.
So you mentioned their children previously. And so how has dealing with their family been for you while you were working on this book?
It's always difficult. I had a literary agent once, whom I returned to, and he said, no, I don't think this is the book for me. But he said, stay away from the family. That way is always trouble. And I ignored him because I felt, hey, how the heck am I going to write this book? The book I want to write, the book, what is it like to really be Black in a family, in a house, in a home, surrounded by segregated institutions of every kind, and how you interact with that world, and how do the children interact with that same world, and so on. Well, there's really only one way, in my opinion, and that is to approach the family. And so I did. And I cut a deal with the family, so to speak. Daughter Kate, she told me one day after I interviewed her, I've interviewed her many, many times for hours, and she told me that she felt a little funny about something she said her mother related to her in-laws, and she was worried about how I'd represent that. And so I said, well, Kate, don't worry about that. I'll tell you what I'm going to do. You want to see what I'm writing? Yes, I do. I really want to see it. Okay. So if you want to see what I'm writing and have an opportunity to comment on it, here's the deal. I will turn it over to you. I'm not going to allow you to censor anything. But if you find a mistake, I want you to notify me help me get it. Help me get it right. So that was a deal. And when I finally finished my first draft, it was it was about 40% longer than what you've got there, and it's not exactly a short book. I called her up one day and talked to her, and so I said, "Well, you know, what'd you think?" And a couple times she had called me and said, "You know, this is inaccurate. That's inaccurate." And she said, "I think it is a very, very, very good book." That is what she said to me. Now, other members of the family apparently since have a different take on that, and exactly what that is, I don't know. I mean, I don't know, but I know I upheld my end of the bargain. I did my best to make it as accurate as I could. And if you read that book, you will discover that unlike, let's just say, quickie biographies, there's an awful lot of detail in it, and it's written like a novel. So there's an incredible amount of detail, and there's a lot of opportunity to get things wrong. And I did everything I could do not to get it wrong.
What is the, you mentioned learning about the Dahl test in one of your college classes. So is it still performed and taught today?
Yes, college students are still learning about it, and it's being replicated even today. There have been subsequent Dahl tests all over the world. This is a very famous test. It's been replicated that I know of in Italy, Union of South Africa, Trinidad and Tobago, Australia, New Zealand, and I'm sure some that I left out, and in multiple states across the United States. I mean, it wouldn't surprise me if every single state somebody has done a Dahl test. The two boxes in the Library of Congress that have the papers related to the Dahl test, the test sheets, they're actual test sheets with all of Kenneth's quotes and scribbling on them. He quoted the children, the things they said. He took notes on the grimaces or the grins or the cries that they uttered when they were being tested. I mean, that's all down there. And I do stray from my main point there. Where was I? I'm sorry.
Oh, you were talking about the other places that the Dahl test has been replicated.
Oh, okay. Those two boxes are among the most popular in the Library of Congress. And you know, it's not just scholars that go into those boxes, it's kids. Because even children, high school kids, have performed Dahl tests. Now, there's a young girl, well, she's not a young girl anymore. She's a young woman, Carrie Davis. She and her mom, her mother helped her, I gather, do a Dahl test of her own. And they filmed it. And she also filmed a number of her friends, her classmates, girls, commenting on how they felt about their racial identity. And she produced a 7-minute video that you can get on YouTube. So even children, even kids, a lot of college kids have done this. In fact, Kenneth once said that he gave the four original dolls away to a Columbia, or Barnard or Columbia University student who was doing a Dahl test study, and she never returned them. So.
All right, folks, if you'd like to ask a question, for the folks listening in online, just wait until I bring the mic around. And for those of you who are watching online, type your questions into the Q&A box. So let's get started.
Hi.
Hello.
Thank you. This was so great learning about how you wrote this story. And I think my first question is, you had mentioned that they did this testing amongst kids who were in segregated schools and non-segregated schools.
Right.
So I'm wondering how they were able to use their results to provide evidence to support Brown versus Board of Ed if the results were the same across segregated and non-segregated schools.
Well, the results were not identical. There was an 8% difference margin of 8%, more, and became very controversial because the segregationists before the Supreme Court made hay out of this. They argued that the segregationists argued that if the Clark's results showed that the Northern children were less likely to select a white doll, let's see if I'm getting this right. If the Southern children were less likely to select a white doll, then what does that say about the terrible effects of segregation? That's almost a quotation of the head of the segregationist legal team. That's what he said before the Supreme Court. So your question was exactly what? Well, I've forgotten now.
Well, basically, I was trying to figure out like what the difference was between the kids in the segregated versus non-segregated schools, or like if the results were the same, which I realize they're not now, how they could use that to argue against segregation.
Well, that's a great question, because that was a segregationist argument, and I think what Kenneth would say is that you couldn't separate out what effect the school versus all the other aspects of American racism are in this child's response. I mean, that's impossible to separate out. Early on, Thurgood Marshall asked Kenneth, Kenneth, does this prove that segregation damages children's minds? Does this prove that segregated schools damage children's self-esteem? And Kenneth said, no, it doesn't prove it, because there are all these other factors.
So can you speak to, you've alluded to it a little bit, but sometimes I think there is a bit of a distortion of the results. You just spoke to how segregation can damage self-esteem, but I think sometimes it has been, I think, distorted, in my opinion, or misinterpreted to not that this is the effect of racism, but the argument of, well, Black children need to be around white people in order to feel good about themselves, if that makes sense. So not so much about the differences in terms of access to appropriate materials, access to having school buses to get them to school, but more like it's, well, you know, Black children have poor self-esteem because they're among other Black people.
I'm a little confused about what exactly are you asking? What
did the Clarks talk about that, or from what you have read, did they have a response to that?
I'm not sure they had a response that's public to precisely that argument. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure they would realize, I'm pretty sure that they were sophisticated enough and smart enough to realize that there was a lot of power in that argument. Because, let's put it this way, it has been often said to me from people roughly my age that grew up in segregated schools and neighborhoods, and we talk about Black people, that they were never harmed because they were so protected. And that's what actually Mamie said about herself. Mamie was worried when she first put all this data together. She's the one that did all that work, calculating and arranging it all in tables. I mean, that took a lot more time than Kenneth spent testing the kids. Mamie said, geez, I wonder if I'm permanently damaged by this. And she came to the conclusion, no, I wasn't. And why wasn't I? I wasn't because I had a loving family. I had a loving, she was associated with two loving and very active churches, and just a Black community that was thriving and very healthy atmosphere in Hot Springs. And so she felt that she had adjusted very well. What Kenneth often said is that, Kenneth said that many of these children adjusted. They adjusted in time. They don't all end up maladjusted. No, but with what amount of burden of pain and suffering most people cannot imagine. That's what he said. So I don't think Kenneth ever said, Dahl test results, therefore black inferiority complex, case closed, proven. I don't think he ever said that. He had a much more subtle mind than that. And he didn't intend anyone. Now, that's part of why he said it raised questions about the education and mental hygiene of black children. See, that is a really sharp mind.
Fascinating. You mentioned results, the words results, prove, test. My general question is, does a budding writer reach a point where he or she says, you know, I'm fascinated by this topic, but it's so scientific, I just don't want to tackle it? Or do you encourage us? I've got that same problem. I got a memoir, but I've got legal issues. I'm trying to understand the legal issues, but I didn't go to law school, you know, and I'm thinking to myself, maybe I'm jumping in too deep. So when you look at the Dahl test, and did you find that you could master some of those scientific, you know, issues there wasn't a problem? Or do we get into situations where we have to be careful? Maybe we shouldn't attempt something, even though we want to.
Well, I attempted it. That's obvious. You got the two covers there. In the back, it's between two covers. Maybe I shouldn't have. I mean, maybe I was crazy. I often thought I was. I am definitely out of my depth. I'm not a psychologist. But I just said, look, you know, just put what you know out there. Put what is known out there by others, and let the reader decide. You know, I think you can make a very good argument that the Dahl test was a primitive examination or exploration of black racial identity at an early time in the history of psychology. And it didn't answer everything. It may not have gotten a lot of things right. It may have gotten some things right. But damn it, I mean, this thing is, there have been three movies that have been partly founded on this. The Dahl industry actually has hired a PhD, a black scholar who did a Dahl test dissertation. And so the Dahl industry today uses the concepts that the Clarks generated, developed, to bring in more people from the outside, diverse groups, to look at the design of each one of their Dahls. What I'm trying to say is, look, got all these young people and scholars doing Dahl tests of their own. These people had a hell of an impact on our society, our popular culture, and our law. And to just say, well, no, this is too difficult. I don't want to try it. Nah, I waded right in, and probably incautiously, and I'll catch hell now and then for doing it. But somebody needed to do it.
I want to thank all of you for being here, but most of all, I want to thank Tim for that wonderful discussion and for writing the Clark story. Thank you.
Thank you, Allison. And thanks for everyone.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Be sure to subscribe so you are notified when new episodes are released. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.